SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Why do people want to be at work? To feel heard, appreciated, part of something, and to know there's a career path for everyone. Inclusive workplaces are linked to increased innovation, productivity, and employee satisfaction. Make your organisation a place where people want to be. For inclusion and diversity training, visit inclusion-program.com.au.
The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
I mean, that's crazy how much the world has changed, right? I mean, you just can't plan for a thing like that.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS, and I'm joined by my co-host, SBS Channel Manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Fi. How's it going?
Oh, you know, 5 months in, zooming up the storm. I'm all right. How are you?
Good, good. Yeah, it's the new normal. Just like film festivals becoming virtual, which is part of what we're talking about this week on The Playlist, because, Fiona, you'll be giving us a roundup of this year's curfewed Melbourne International Film Festival, MIFF 68.5. And talking with the creators of the real-life BBC drama coming soon to SBS, The Salisbury Poisonings. And we talk Indian matchmaking in What Have You Been Watching? And click play on a couple of OD picks.
It's quite a bit. Let's get into it.
Sophie, I think you've spent the last week immersed in the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yes, I have. Remotely. It is a digital festival this year, as are all the others, unfortunately. But shout out to all our friends in Melbourne who are in the perennial lockdown. But, you know, I am grateful that film festivals have found a way to still occur this year. Just speaking for myself, they've been the bright highlight of my winters, you know, Sydney and then Melbourne. So it's a testament, I guess, to creative thinking and the quick moving that these festivals still been able to occur and work well. Like, they're all digital platforms, and touch wood, but it's been quite easy to access the films, and they've all played without a hitch. Having said that, now I've jinxed myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all thank the internet gods that streaming seems to be working in a reasonable capacity before this once in 100-year pandemic struck.
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of kind of program has Melbourne brought to us this year?
Well, it is quite a big program considering, you know, obviously there are fewer films around this year because fewer films were able to be finished by the time these festivals were all starting to plan their programs. But, you know, it's quite a big offering considering, and with a lot of the new films that, you know, we're getting buzz out of Sundance, which was kind of, and Berlin, which were sort of the last festivals to really happen. There was a Cannes, which, again, I don't want to say thanks to the pandemic, but because of the pandemic, I was able to attend in inverted commas digitally, but there was a very reduced program of Cannes this year as well. But that said,
Sydney was very slimmed down as well.
Yes, of course, Sydney was very slimmed down. It was, again, that was very rapidly put together as well. But so Melbourne has a great mix of docs and features, and as is often the way, I just live for the docs really at these festivals because, and quite often that's, I've said in the past, you know, it's these films that really benefit from the festival experience and watching with an audience, and some of the docs that unfold, you know, you can really, watching it with an audience makes it that much better.
Yeah, I agree with that, but you're not getting that now.
No, you're not. Just the audience in your household. So, yeah, there's just, speaking for myself, there's been two of us watching these docs. So not quite the same, not exactly a full Capitol Theatre or, you know, a full State Theatre if you're in Sydney. But, you know, it is what it is, and we're grateful to be able to see them. Anyway, I'll just run off a couple of my favourites so far of MIFF.
Yeah, terrific.
There's a great film called Mare, which is by American director David Osit. And this one, it follows an actual mayor of Ramallah, the city in Palestine. And it's this city that doesn't get a lot of coverage in representations of the Middle East, certainly. And it's a town where it's, how do I explain this, Doc? It's sort of part Parks and Rec, a little bit Veep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of a fly on the wall, walking in the shoes of this mayor in a town, in a city that sort of doesn't have a country because it's in Palestine and it's surrounded by Israel. The town is planning its Christmas celebration because it's quite a Christian town.
Yeah.
And they're talking about branding, talking about footpaths and plumbing. But then on the fifth day of the shoot of this lengthy time embedded with the mayor, Musa Hadid, one occupant of the White House, Mr. Trump, announces that he wants to move the Israeli embassy, the American embassy in Israel, and that's what kicks off a big geopolitical moment in the film because of what it does to the people in Ramallah. Yeah. So it's this contrast between macro and micro of like small bureaucracy with big moments in the Middle East politics.
Yeah, Trump once again leaves his imprint.
Yeah, exactly. So just a shout out as well. I've had a chat to David Osit. So there's an interview that will be up on SBS Movies if you want to read a bit more about this film. But again, that's another one that would really benefit from watching with an audience because of the humour in watching conversations about footpaths, but then how the bigger picture starts to some of the bigger scenes that are in this documentary. I won't spoil it because I'm sure it will make its way to cinemas when, you know, one hopes.
It makes me think of a couple of documentaries involving mayoral fights, Street Fight, which we did mention previously, but also Rats in the Ranks, the great Australian doco.
Absolutely.
About the mayor of Leichhardt. Which is certainly a favourite of mine. But I do have to admit, when you began to explain this, I did for a moment think you were talking about a documentary about a horse.
Sure, yes. If you see it spelt, that would clear that up, unless the horse's name was Mare. But yes, good point. And while we're on the subject of local politics, there's a documentary series from Steve James, who we know from Hoop Dreams and from America to Me that you mentioned a couple of episodes back.
Mm.
He's got a new documentary series called A City So Real that is on at MIF. And this one follows the mayoral elections for Chicago. So, yeah, this is I want to say, four-part doco series that really gets into the nuts and bolts of this mayoral campaign to replace Rahm Emanuel, who resigned. So, yeah, it really gets into just some of the bizarre processes involved in mayoral campaigns and some really specific issues related to Chicago. It really gets in there, as you would expect with Steve James, if you're familiar with his work. It's excellent.
Great. As we once mentioned previously, you've never seen The Wire, but there is a season of The Wire that focuses all within City Hall and on the office of the mayor.
Well, look, I'm on a roll here, so maybe if it's that angle that gets me into watching The Wire, I know it's great, I just haven't found the time. Yeah. Look, it's going to be this. And just for something completely different, there's another doc on the Go-Go's, the famous girl band from the 80s, that is excellent. And it follows from the very beginning, like their punk origins, through to the big pop hits and beyond. And look, I knew the hits, but I've never been a big follower of the Go-Go's, so I didn't realise they had quite so many albums. And this is a really warts and all documentary about them, with talking heads from all the members, including some who left and some who came in to replace those who left. And they don't skimp on the details. Like, it gets into the drug stuff, it gets into the rivalries. So it's not just one for the fans. It goes back to their punk origins through to the perception of them as being sellouts when they started to make it big. So it covers sort of early days of punk up to their pop hits and also the perception of them being sellouts when they started to make bucket loads of money. But it also touches on the sexism that they encountered in the music industry. I'm not breaking any news here, but, yeah, just the backlash against them because, you know, they were the first all-female group to have hit a number one album in their debut album. And, there's a lot of great stories in here. So I think that, yeah, that was a really excellent doc and I learned a whole lot more than I knew about the Go-Go's.
And, Fee, if you were to pick out a Go-Go's tune, what would it be?
Well, like I said, I mean, I wasn't hugely familiar with their whole catalogue, so I only really knew Our Lips Are Sealed and We Got The Beat, but yeah, probably of those two, Our Lips Are Sealed. sometimes called Alex the Seal. But what about you, Ben? What's your favourite?
Are you a big Go-Go's fan? I'll back you on that. And the documentary was called The Go-Go's.
The Go-Go's, yep. Just straight up The Go-Go's. And look, I've done a bit of a doc focus. There's another great one, 9 to 5 Story of a Movement, which I'm a big Dolly fan, and you would be familiar with the movie 9 to 5 and the song, of course. Being a karaoke demon as you are, Ben, I'm sure you're aware of 9 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
But this film, this doc, is the story of the movement that was then depicted in 9 to 5. The film with Dolly and Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda, because like some people might think that the movement came in light of the film, but in actual fact, Jane Fonda was aware of this kind of workplace overhaul really that started with secretaries and was just an attempt to get recognition for the work that women were doing in offices that was unrecognised and, you know, these vague job descriptions that were basically making women kind of work wives, having to do all the sort of life admin for their employees. And of course, the harassment that comes part and parcel with that. So it's a story of feminism in the American workplace for women. Yeah, and it's a really interesting documentary that was there as well.
Oh, sounds good.
Yeah. And I'll finish off with one fictional film, a narrative film that I hope is still getting a cinema release because it's fantastic. And it was a special preview screening at MIFF through Palace Films, Corpus Christi. A Polish film, which the name might be familiar because it was nominated for an Oscar early in the year. Remember the Oscars all those months ago? The last good thing that happened when Parasite won. Yeah, so Corpus Christi, a Polish film, and the less you know about it, the better. So I'll just give really the top line synopsis of it. But it's kind of set, it opens in a juvenile detention centre, I suppose, which is very religious, and there's a religious order to it. And one of these kids is getting released and he wants to be a priest, but his background, you know, prohibits that. So heads off to a new life and ends up faking life as a priest. So he becomes a priest without any of the ordination. And yeah, it's fascinating to watch him give a really good sermon, but yeah, you just are waiting for his past to catch up with him. And it's fantastic. Corpus Christi.
Oh, okay. Well, there was 4 great picks as part of the MIFF 68.5 virtual festival. Do you know how long that's running until, Fee?
So MIFF runs until the 23rd of August.
All right. Well, a little window there for people to hop onto those films. And if you do miss out, I'm sure some of them will be released in some other capacity somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. We can only hope.
So, Fee, a couple of episodes ago we talked about The Salisbury Poisonings, which is a new 4-part drama. Was a big success when it launched in the UK earlier in the year, and it's coming to SBS from August 24th. And you had a chance to speak to the two creators.
I did, because what fascinated me, like I say, it's 4-part drama, but it's based on real-world events that are quite recent, the Salisbury poisonings that happened in kind of about this time 2 years ago in the city of Salisbury.
Yeah, so in drama terms, it's very quick turnaround.
Very quick turnaround. So I want to, yeah, I was really just seeing how it plays out and it's, you know, a really riveting drama. I was really curious, how did they write this? What was the timeline of this? And also, you know, you're dealing with real people, actual people depicted, you know, it's their real names, it's their relationships and whatnot. So, yeah, I was really curious, how do you go about adapting something like this in such a tight turnaround? So, yeah, I reached out to the co-writers, Declan Law and Adam Patterson, who are also executive producers of the show, and they've got a journalism background, so I guess that helps in the way this story is told. But no, they were great. So let's have a listen to Declan Lorne and Adam Patterson.
Hi there, how you doing?
Hi, good, thanks. How are you?
Good, very well, thank you. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
Hi, Fiona, nice to meet you.
Hello, great to meet you too. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for taking the time and congratulations. It's
pretty special. I saw all four parts.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Okay, that's great.
Great. Yeah. We're really glad you like it. Like, obviously, it was a kind of labor of love for quite a long time. So if someone tells us they've enjoyed it, it makes us happy.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. And I mean, I don't say that to everyone, so you don't know me, but I would. An obvious point to start. I mean, how did you come to make it as a show? I mean, it's very recent history. At what point in the timeline did this become a show you were considering?
We went down to Salisbury as early, it was 2018 September, and that was really recent. Don Sturgis had only passed away a few months before. You know, the world's media had been focused on Salisbury for months and months and months, and we were asked to go down there by Dancing Ledge Productions to have a look and to see whether there was a drama there to be told. Declan and I are former journalists. We were working current affairs for, you know, a decade. Declan is a reporter and myself as a producer. So we kind of went down there with our journalism hat on and thought, you know, is there really a new story to tell here? Here we really weren't sure. We kind of, we thought it might have been told already. And we sort of said to each other, like, we're only going to do this if we can find a new angle and bring something new. And also, more importantly, if the people that have been affected really agree to being part of this, because the trauma would be so recent. And so there's a lot of ethical concerns there. But very quickly after we arrived, we realized that there was a completely untold story in Salisbury about a local response effort. People, civil servants, you know, local policemen, people who literally came together with this unprecedented threat of a nerve agent on their doorstep, and whose decision-making saved countless lives. And so when we started speaking to people like Tracy Daskovich, the director of public health, who's one of the leads in the show, we realized that not only was there a story that should be told, that we realized that, you know, the world didn't know about it at all. We just couldn't believe that, you know, this is a woman who would ordinarily deal with food hygiene seminars and outbreaks of NITs, and she's suddenly cordoning off vast swathes of the city to prevent this invisible agent spreading. We were inspired to tell their story, but it took a long time to get everyone on board, because everyone had suffered media fatigue, and they were understandably, you know, kind of reluctant initially to talk to us. So it took, as you know yourself, it takes a lot of time, and we had to build up a lot of trust. But we had an agreement with ourselves, with the BBC, with Dancing Ledge, that we wouldn't take the story forward unless these principal people whose lives have been so greatly affected, unless they signed up and said, please tell our story. Because for us, that would be a ridiculous situation to represent them like so soon after these events if they didn't want to be involved. But thankfully they did. One by one, they signed up. They saw that we really wanted to do justice to their story, and they all got behind the drama. And that's the only way it worked.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, for sure. And so what were some of the questions you asked them? As you say, not a lot of people knew about the individuals behind this mammoth effort. What were some of the questions that you drew out of them?
Okay, it's not so much that the questions were consistent, it's that we were consistent. And by that I mean, you know, we just went back down to them time and time and time again. We made documentaries for years, and one of the things that often frustrated us would be that you would land on someone's doorstep and need an answer from them, maybe not that night, but very soon, whether they're going to take part. And by take part, I mean, like, give us this really difficult testimony to, you know, put on screens all around the country. That often troubled us. Like, it's difficult because you're putting a lot of pressure on people. But with this project, we didn't have to do that. We basically said, no, the decision lies with you. You call us when you're ready. And I think, you know, that gives people a lot more confidence that you're just not there for a smash and grab job to, you know, grab testimony and run off. We're saying to them, you know, we can only make this if you go the whole journey with us, not just through interviews. But if you look at the scripts and say, my character may or may not say that, or, you know, you've forgotten about this. And, you know, so that level of consultation, you know, not only helps them, but helps us in representing real people. So with factual drama, you know, we often say factual drama is not a game, because it's not. You know, you've got a huge responsibility. We may ask the same questions again and again, but it's more just that you're always there for them, and that they understand that at any stage they can put their hand up and say, I'm not that comfortable with that. And I think when you've got that balance going on, that's when factual drama can work well, especially when you're representing something that's just happened. It may be slightly different to something that happened 30 years ago, but we're talking something that's still, for example, an active investigation. You know, it's very, very, very recent. Mm-hmm. So you need to be very conscious of those things.
So you made a real effort to be true to their stories and be authentic and represent them authentically. How did you balance that with needing to make a compelling drama as well? Sort of, you know, did you take any artistic liberties, maybe not with their own personal stories, but how did you balance being authentic with, you know, making a tight drama for television?
Yeah. First of all, it was really important to us to stick as closely as possible to the testimony of the people in it. That was very, very important. And where we had to diverge, we always run it by them. I mean, all of the real people in it, Ross and Mo Cassidy and Sarah Bailey, Tracy Daskovich, the Sturgis family, they all saw the scripts as we went along. And where things hadn't happened exactly as they had in real life, they signed off and said, that's fine if that's what you need to do. But we were kind of lucky in that the story was so inherently dramatic and so crazy that we didn't really have to take major artistic liberties. I would say maybe there's two things. One, the events happened over a period of 9 months and we had to consolidate that into 3 hours. So it looks like in the series, things that happened in a week, in real life, it probably happened over the course of a month. And then the other thing was, I guess every time you choose a point of view in a drama, every time you have a protagonist, you're obviously leaving out lots of other stories that could have been told around this incident. But in terms of massive artistic liberties, we were just lucky in the story we were telling that we didn't really have to do that.
Yeah, the narratives were there. I mean, the structure was there. You know, there's this kind of crazy enemy that they defeat, then rises again in a new way. They then have to defeat it again. Lots of people suffer along the way. You know, we used the analogy of Jaws quite a lot, you know, the sharks back in the water, you know, it was all there dramatically. So we weren't drawn to temptation because we just didn't have to. And I think, you know, with something so recent, I just don't think Declan and I could have operated that way. We would have only undertaken the story if we felt that there was sufficient narrative and story there to stick closely to the facts.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The Jaws analogy is a good one. I mean, also, you know, Spielberg didn't really show the shark for a long part of the movie, but here it's an invisible enemy. And I mean, I can't not bring up the weird parallels with COVID. What are your thoughts with this coming out now when we're all checking surfaces and there's a lot of, you know, we can all relate to contact tracing now.
we can't believe the residences. When we went to Salisbury, we wanted to tell a story about a community, and our theme was community versus chaos, and that's partly because Adam and I grew up during the conflict in Northern Ireland, and there was a lot of chaos, and then the response to that was communities coming together and families being a kind of antidote to that. So I think that was a kind of sub-inspiration for telling the story in the way that we did. But we said about it, we were dealing with a contaminant and an invisible threat, and we had to learn all about a public health response and contact tracing and lockdown. And so the series was finished and completely locked off and done, and COVID and Adam, but also the emotional themes of a community having to deal with chaos in its midst and having to find strength and resilience. I mean, I guess, Adam, it's fair to say we kind of couldn't believe what was happening. And I don't mean that in a good way. We weren't happy about it.
I think that's a really good point. Like, we weren't sitting there thinking, oh, we're very fortunate that the world now understands what Tracy and everyone in Salisbury went through. But what we did think is, like, maybe, you know, now with the public kind of, I think the optics on heroism, for example, has shifted a lot during, you know, the COVID pandemic. And that's what we were trying to do a bit with Salisbury. It was to say, you know, these are heroes, these local people, these boots on the ground people who, you know, literally, you know, will go over the top for you, will lie down in traffic for you, even though they don't know you, to try and protect you. These are the people that are the glue in society, that are holding society together. And I think now, you know, through COVID, like the world has finally garnished a greater appreciation for frontline workers. So with that in mind, it is amazing that we chose a public health official as the kind of lead in a BBC drama. And now it's people like that, that people are finally saying, you're the people that are keeping us, you know, that are keeping us straight here at the moment. So yeah, the parallels are crazy. We never thought it was fortunate, but it is frightening that, you know, we had never heard of contact tracing when we interviewed Tracy Daskovich. And then when the show goes out, it's lingo in everyone's lips. Everyone understands it. I mean, that's crazy. How much the world has changed, right? I mean, you just can't plan for a thing like that.
But
I think it is, just to kind of round up, I think it's important that the show goes out to the world right now, because I think the thing that will surprise people a lot about the Salisbury poisonings is that it is an uplifting show in many ways. It's about, you know, how to deal with chaos together. As Declan said, the theme is community versus chaos. But in the face of something kind of crazy and unprecedented, we can either fall apart or we can work together. And I think this team of people in Salisbury showed that they, you know, what happens if you work well.
When we pitched the show to the BBC, the commissioner, whose name is Lucy Richard, she said, oh, you want to make a show about ordinary heroes? And he kind of summed up very well exactly what we were doing. And that was it. Ordinary heroes was what it was about, really.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, ordinary heroism, exactly.
And how did you know when to end it, or how to end it, really? You know, Disney's still an active, never really stopped, did it? But, how did you know, okay, that's our ending?
I think we felt that for us anyway, there seemed to be a natural conclusion after Dawn Sturgis's funeral and the emotional fallout of that. So all of our characters suffered. Tracy Daskovich felt guilt. She felt like she'd missed something, and it took her a long time to come to terms with it. Mm-hmm. Nick Bailey was suffering post-traumatic stress and still is to this day. And so we thought, well, we have Dawn's funeral, and then we have everyone suffering. But then we wanted the fight of the series to be not about suffering and fallout and consequence, but to be about resilience. And because that was the end point for us. All of these people had found a way to begin to deal with it through their families and their community connections. Mm. That is why this series ends as it does. There's a lot of suffering, but ultimately they find resilience.
Yeah, I think you're breaking up a wee bit, Dick, but I think basically just to round up on that as well, you know, there is no ending for a story like this, you know, and I think that's the point, you know. We all, again, when we made documentaries, you were often forced by execs, so you need to draw a line and say that's, well, actually the world just keeps going on and on. It's really about what we learn. So I think, you know, at the end, you know, all of the people involved, all of our protagonists are still learning and are still dealing from what's happened to them. And that's where we leave them, because that's where they still are in the world, you know, and will continue to be so.
Yeah. And I'm curious how the two of you work together. What's your process sort of sharing writing duties, and how do you riff off each other?
So basically, we work together. We structure everything in the same room. We have to be in a room for that. We stick yellow post-its up and cover a wall. So we need a really big wall and an awful lot of post-its. And we write out every scene and every beat and we move the pieces around until we're happy with them. And so that can happen anywhere. We did a lot of that in Salisbury in our hotel room, where we would just clear a wall and put the entire series up on the wall. And it's a very, very rewarding and fun thing to do. I guess we just love it. It's very creatively fruitful, basically.
Yeah, there's always an energy that kind of swells when we're together working like that. And it started, you know, when we sort of 7 years ago, when we sat down in my apartment with Microsoft Word and wrote our first short film together. Mm-hmm. There was a connection then, two guys that are like work in the factual journalism world that kind of want to create and inspire ourselves in a new arena. And it was born then, and it just grows and grows, because there is something, we get to places that we wouldn't do by ourselves. And I think if you're working in a team with someone, like, that's what you should always be looking for, someone who drags you to another place that you may not even envision, a place that might not even be somewhere you want to go at times. But when you get there, you look around and think, actually, this is pretty great. So I think when you're working with somebody, the right person, that's the sort of thing that happens. And Deck and I have found, you know,
as he says, like the engine room for every project we do is that storyboarding session. And it always just, we leave, whether it's one day, 2 days, whether it's a week together, we leave that with a show, with an episode, with the show, with a new idea. So it just kind of works. And it's also great fun to work, not be working by yourself. It's great fun to work with one of your best mates.
Yeah, great. Yeah, because, you know, writing can be a lonely pursuit, I imagine. So, no, that's great. And so what else have you got on the boil? Is there anything else you can talk about? Is there much happening in a pandemic?
Yeah. Funny, as writers, we've been very busy over lockdown because everyone's in development now. So they're all looking for ideas and they want ideas ready, they want the script ready to go for when they can shoot again. So we've been pretty busy, but the next thing we're doing is actually directing a film, a feature film called Chasing Agent Freeguard, starring a British actor called James Norton. And we're hoping to shoot that in the spring of next year if the virus allows us to do it. So writing that project, we're directing it because ultimately Adam and I are writers, directors. We want to be able to do both. And so, yeah, we're really, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, basically, like, Deck and I directed documentaries. I did some commercial directing. It was always kind of an aspiration of ours to write and direct in drama, but we wanted to make sure we could write first before we get into the directing. But it's another true story. It's about a real-life con man who was prolific from the mid-90s for 10 years in swindling many different women out of their family fortunes. And it's basically about gaslighting and, you know, coercive control. And it's a very kind of pertinent topic for today, I think. And James Norton will play the lead, the con man. So we're going off to a cottage in a couple of weeks in Ireland to do our post-it notes again for a few days on that.
Another post-it note session.
Yeah, another post-it note session.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. I'd like to wrap things up by asking people what they've been watching. Have you been watching much in lockdown, or are you being too busy making a movie or planning a movie?
No, I it's funny. What have I watched recently? It's one of those questions. My mind always goes blank. I haven't been watching much TV. I mean, a couple of days ago, I watched a really amazing independent art house British film called Bait, which won the kind of best BAFTA newcomer this year, just because it was, you know, shot in 16mm, and the guy, you know, was a real, like, literally had the idea 20 years ago to make this. And it's just that one of those films that's very different to the way Declan and I, you know, view the world creatively. But you just look at that and think, wow, what an amazing commitment to make an amazing piece of work about a small part of the UK in Cornwall. So I just watched that a couple of days ago and it was amazing. But I haven't, you know, I've got a young child and the summer's always a bit manic, so I haven't been committed to any new TV shows at the moment.
No, that's fair. What about you, Declan?
Yeah, I have children. And a lot of Curious George and Postman Pat and so on. Basically, I'm a kind of secret sci-fi. So there's a show on Apple TV called For All Mankind, which is a kind of alternative history about the space race between Russia and America by Ronald D. Moore, who did Battlestar Galactica. So I got addicted to that a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, I guess like everybody, Ozark as well, a big fan of Ozark. So I'm binging quite a lot at the moment.
Yeah, aren't we all? well, look, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. It's been great to talk to you, and congratulations on the show. I'm sure it'll do really well here.
Okay,
thanks for your note.
Bye. Have a great day. Bye.
So that was Declan Lorne and Adam Patterson, the writers of The Salisbury Poisonings, which is coming to SBS on August 24th. So they're obviously in lockdown doing a lot of binge viewing right now.
Yes, to which we can all relate. Well, that sounds like a good segue to what have you been watching? So, Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, I have been doing a fair bit of binging, to be fair, but there's a show that I wanted to chat about. It's been out on Netflix for a little bit now, called Indian Matchmaking. Fiona, have you checked this out?
Yes. Yeah, I've watched an episode.
So I have to say I have been hooked. I sort of just put it on for want of basically just a kind of aimless time filler. And I think I've got an episode to go now. Well, I'll set it up for people first. So it does follow. It is made by a filmmaker, Smriti Mundra, for Netflix. And she had previously made a documentary called A Suitable Girl, and she followed that up by pitching this show to Netflix about a real-life matchmaker based in India, but who actually does a lot of matchmaking for the Indian diaspora, so including in North America. So we sort of see across the show her take on particular clients, whether they be within India or within the US, and then offer them and their families, because their sort of families are often players in these conversations as well, some options for them to choose from, and some quite fussy, some sort of more open to what's on offer, and perhaps sort of a little bit frustrated by their lack of finding a partner through maybe more conventional Western means, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I found this really interesting, and I'm certainly, you know, not from within that culture, and, you know, we can sort of maybe work our way onto that. But in some ways it dispels some of the stereotypes around arranged marriages, because the participants in this show, the clients, certainly have a strong say. You know, ultimately it is up to them whether these relationships proceed or not. So it's certainly not the situation where a relationship is being forced on them by their parent. But at the same time, there's a lot of acknowledgement of the culture from which they're coming. Let's hear a bit from the show.
Cheers.
Cheers.
What would be like a relaxing 10 days for you? What would you do for 10 days?
Why did you put the word relaxing in front of it?
Can you relax?
Not for me. I will talk to you never.
So fickle-minded and fussy. And I'm here to help them. In India, the marriages, they are between two families. So the parents guide their children, and that is the work of a matchmaker.
Very nice person. Understand sense of humor.
You know how I hate comedy.
The clients, they want everything.
Someone charming.
Equal to my pay or higher.
Adjustment is also important.
You have to be attracted to the person, and the person has to be good. I don't think that it's a lot to ask for.
I'm really close to my mom.
I wholeheartedly trust her judgment.
If he doesn't finalize, me and my husband are going to finalize the girl for him. That is what I've decided.
Matchmaking has become a tough job, but I'm trying my best.
Here we are. So.
Yeah.
Fee, what did you think?
Well, yes, as I say, I've only really watched the first episode, but I am likewise hooked. I do need to catch up on the rest. It's a formula, like the way this story is told is a familiar formula. If you see shows like Millionaire Matchmaker or something that's on, like Foxtel has a lot of these kind of reality shows, but where this one departs is it's, I don't know, there is more warmth to it in the way it's told, I think, and it's trying, like you say, like it's showing just a different side of the arranged marriage element that we are familiar with seeing. I know it's come under fire a little bit for the way it deals with caste, and you know, there's some coded phrases with the way people speak to what they want in a partner, and fair skin comes up a lot in some throwaway lines like, oh, he's great, he's tall, he's fair. And, yeah, you just think, whoa, what? So that is kind of a through line that has been critiqued quite heavily, but also held up as, well, it's there for critique because that's the reality of Indian society, and the caste system is heavily in place. So, yeah, I find it fascinating and very compulsive viewing.
Yeah, there's a new season of The Bachelor out on Australian TV, and I haven't been inclined to check this one out at all. Maybe I will catch up there. I won't rule that out. But this certainly is sort of scratching that itch for the moment. And I will sort of engage a bit more in some of that context around the show once it's wrapped up for me, and I will be very interested to understand some of those critiques. And I have also sort of seen, you know, a bit of, as you say, a defence of the program in that it's not representing anything that doesn't exist in this sort of matchmaking culture. Mm. So in some ways, you know, we need to kind of acknowledge that. But I do find the production model, again, of Netflix very interesting, where, you know, this has been seen as a real way for them to target growing an audience in India, and at the same time reach sort of diasporas sort of worldwide, which is something that Netflix can kind of do that very few other, you know, sort of producers of content are able to do. And and it has the benefit of just sort of making Netflix's content in particular much more diverse than a lot of what we've seen, which has sort of been, you know, much more US-centric from other producers of content. So I find that fascinating. And I just sort of do think, you know, where would I ever have seen a Bachelor-style show which was entirely made up of brown people?
Yeah, right.
There's a sort of a lot I've been getting out of it, and kind of, I guess, sort of ultimately it's just got me hooked on the level of wanting to see the people I like find someone.
You're really rooting for them there.
Yeah.
And I mean, it all comes back, like a lot of everything does when it comes to representation. I mean, it's if this is the only spotlight on a community or in a culture that you see, then you would have greater issues with it. But, you know, it's about having more around so that Indian matchmaking isn't the only story you see.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the test in a way will be, if Netflix is serious about engaging with India, what other Indian local content do they produce, and how successful are they in making it engaging for a wider international audience? I suppose sort of that does feel like that's the business model that they're working towards, and that will be, you know, really what either sustains them or doesn't into the future.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like you say, like they've got the reach. They're in homes around the world, so there's this real focus on telling more broader stories. Yeah, we all get to benefit from it, especially with all being in our homes so much.
And Fee, apart from a lot of myth, or maybe there's even more myth that you haven't told us about, what have you been watching?
Mm. Yes, well, yeah, I did go through my myth watch list. There actually is another one I can mention if you're keen. It's another doc, actually. This one is called Coded Bias. And, yeah, this one's a great one to sink your teeth into. It's a documentary about literally the bias that is inherent within artificial intelligence and machine learning. So you think technology, you know, it should be a supposedly neutral world, just full of bits and bytes, listen to me. But, you know, that's actually layered with embedded racism and privilege because of the people who are doing the programming. There's a great doc broadly about machine learning called Machine that you can watch at SBS On Demand. But this doc, Coded Bias, drills more deeper into this issue of, the racism and sexism and all the isms that are built into this world of artificial intelligence, because basically technology is so full of men and white men that their programs and systems replicate. So they kind of copy the people who are building the programs. The starting point, it takes a perspective of a computer scientist at MIT, Joy Bulamwini, who she shares the experience of having built basically an app. It's called an Aspire Mirror, and it, in a way, replicates someone's face onto yours. Sort of just think like a Snapchat filter, but a bit more detailed, but where it projects a face onto yours for kind of an empowering aspirational moment. Someone like Serena Williams, or like a lion, something like that, yeah, which sounds great. But she found, she's a black woman, and the camera didn't recognise her face, and it actually took, this is ridiculous, but it took putting a white mask, like literally a blank white mask on her face for to recognise her, right? And she built the thing. So, yeah, it comes from that ridiculous starting point to think, well, that's not, how can that be? And then we proceed to find out how that can be. And lots of real-world examples, and so it's a good one. So that one is called Coded Bias, and I'm sure that one will do the rounds, and who knows, may even make it to SBS one day. But, Coded Bias, it's a very good one. And that is also playing at MIF.
Well, good to know that technology is really leading us to have all of the isms just reinforced and that dystopia that television presents the future as is actually where we're headed.
Oh yeah, for sure. but that sounds as depressing as all hell. But the in the best way, it introduces a number of people who are leading the way to try and overturn these racist and ismist practices and systems. And you know, they're all women that are, as they're shown in this doc. And it's really very inspiring and uplifting. So you know, it's depressing as all hell, but then it ends on a high with hopes that things might. These people working for change.
Well, that's left me feeling a bit better about the world.
Oh, good. So now it's time to turn our attention to SBS On Demand and introduce a couple of personal recommendations for things you can watch. Ben, what do you suggest this week?
Well, I'm going to pull out a little mini-series from 2017 that's sitting on SBS On Demand. And it is written by John Ridley, the American writer, perhaps best known for 12 Years a Slave. But, you know, he's been sort of working in the US TV and film industry for a long time. He created American Crime to be distinguished from American Crime Story, different series, but acclaimed nonetheless. And then he created this series, Guerrilla, for UK television. So he's sort of brought the US sensibility to the UK in some ways. And it's interesting in that it's a historic drama set in the 70s in a period of, you know, rapid social change with race at the forefront. And we have these characters played by Frida Pinto. Idris Elba is a sort of wise voice of reason here. Babu Cisse. And they are basically involved in radical politics, sort of think similar to Black Panther movement, kind of pushing to the point of carrying out what could be described as terrorist actions in order to drive political change. I think one thing that makes it interesting is that it has such a feeling of authenticity. For me, anyway, it drove me to do what I think a lot of television based on real life does for me, which is lead me to Wikipedia and to check out the real events on which these stories were based. And then to my surprise, actually, this is a purely fictional story. So in some ways, I think that that's worth knowing going in. And that probably allows the story to do some things. It can kind of, you know, just sort of create a scenario not bound on the reality of circumstances, and maybe that helps reveal some truths about that period in history. But I think at the same time, I guess it sort of left me feeling slightly frustrated, because I feel like the history of that period and the politics of that period are so rich. I don't know that we need to sort of make up groups that didn't exist and stories that didn't exist. But I guess sort of it's sort of that tension in a way, I guess, between fictional and factual storytelling and which one's the right form for getting a particular message across. So that's Guerrilla, and all episodes are out on SBS On Demand now.
Great.
Fee, what OD pick do you have for us?
All right. Well, my one is a movie, and I did talk about this when it was at the cinemas a couple of years ago now, but it's Burning. And this is a film from South Korea by Lee Chang-dong. And, yeah, I can't recommend this highly enough. I love it. And it's a really gripping kind of a noir movie, and it's mysterious. And from the outset, this is not a criticism, but it probably helps to know to set it up, but like it's quite a long movie. It's about 2.5 hours, I think, and it's quite slow in its pacing, but absolutely pays off, and I think it needs the time to sort of build this mystery around these strange characters. So it's kind of a toxic triangle, and it's our hero here is quite a poor and a shy and a little bit slow guy called Jong-soo, who he meets up with a girl he went to school with, Haemi, who she's completely out of his league, and both of them know it, but they sort of strike up a friendship and are quasi-relationship sort of, but yeah, there's no doubting whether she holds the cards in that friendship. But she heads off on a holiday and he is enlisted to feed her cat while she's away and to pick her up from the airport when she's back, which he does. And when she gets back, she's hooked up with a new guy and he's hot and rich and Jong-su is sort of on the outer. But this other guy, Ben, he doesn't see Jong-su as any kind of a threat. So there's this weird triangle going on with these three now. And then something happens, and I'll sort of not, try not spoil it too much, but, yeah, there's, then the dynamic shifts in this relationship quite dramatically. So I don't know if I'm building up the mystique enough for you there, but it's a really poetic kind of a telling of a story that really gets at class and male insecurity as well, sort of this richer kind of a slacker. Like he's charming, this other guy is charming and he gets away with a whole lot of shit because he's hot and charming and rich, whereas Jong-su has had to work every single day of his life. And the performances are really fantastic and they really build character. It's quite gripping, I find. And it had a cinema run, but, yeah, I don't think enough people saw it. So I want to give a bit of a shout to Burning. I think it's very much worth the time.
Great. Well, viewing plans are made. Mm-hmm. And I think that brings us to the end of the show for another week.
I think so.
Make sure you listen to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, give us a lot of stars, leave us a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Until next week.
Thanks for listening.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.